Hello and welcome to the American Writers Museum Author Talks podcast, where we bring the power of the written word straight to your ears. This week, journalist and author Kosoko Jackson discusses his young adult novel Survive the Dome with writer and educator Jacob E. Cochran. This conversation was recorded live at the American Writers Festival on May 15th, 2022 in Chicago. We hope you enjoy entering the mind of a writer.
Welcome to this program of the American Writers Festival. My name is Courtney Borjas, and I am a program coordinator here at the American Writers Museum, and I'm here to introduce our guests for our next event today. In the world of the new book, Survive the Dome, a violent and corrupt government regime curtails protests by locking its citizens in and keeping information from getting out. We're here to talk to author Kosoko Jackson about the world he's created and the brave journalists in it who risk their lives to lead their fellow citizens to freedom. Jackson is a digital media specialist focusing on digital storytelling, email, social and incident marketing, and a freelance political journalist. Occasionally, his personal essays and short stories have been featured in Medium, Thought Catalog, The Advocate, and some literary magazines. When not writing YA novels that champion holistic representation of Black queer youth across genres, he can be found obsessing over movies, drinking his umpteenth Lungton Fog, or spending far too much time on Twitter. His sophomore YA novel, Survive the Dome, will come out in 2022, published by Sourcebook Fire. He'll be interviewed by Jacoby Cochran, a writer, educator, and storyteller from the South Side of Chicago. He is the host of CityCast Chicago, a daily news podcast about all things Chicago. Please join me in welcoming Kosoko and Jacoby.
Kosoko, are you as uncomfortable with bios as I am?
Yeah, and my bio needs to be updated every single time. I'm like, oh, this is an old bio.
Every time someone asks me for a bio, I'm always tempted to just be like, my name Kobe, I'm from the South Side. That's all we need to do here. Well, I'm so excited to talk to you about your book, Survive the Dome. But before we jump into it, in the last few years, you've written Yesterday is History, I'm So Not Over You, and Survive the Dome. I mean, you've been busy. Like, has all this writing helped you navigate the pandemic, the protests? How has your prolific writing helped you?
Yeah, I definitely think, like, I think this question comes up often, even just like in writer like circles, like, how has your writing been during the pandemic? How has the pandemic affected your writing? And like, I've written more in the pandemic than I've ever written anytime else. Like, I think I wrote 3 or 4 books that are going to be published in the past 2 years. That's like a book every 6 months, which is a lot of writing, and I'm exhausted and tired. I think part of it is that, like, in the first like year living in the New York area, being super isolated, instead of doom scrolling, I just like wrote, which was super, super helpful to kind of like not have to deal with the world at large. And those are like all coming to fruition now. So it was great to have this writing, but now I need to like edit it and market it and do all the additional writing things.
Well, these three different books, while they, you know, have similar themes, they're very different. What's the red thread that unites these books that you've written in the last couple years?
I think the thread that I always like to like say is like my brand is like positive queer Black stories. I was doing an event a couple weeks ago and someone mentioned that people are either a branded house or a house of brands. And I thought that was like really, really interesting that either you have a whole bunch of different brands or all of your things fall under one brand. And I really think that like I'm a house of brands, which is queer Black empowerment. Like I don't have queer Black characters who die in my stories, very much like Jordan Peele. When he said that in an interview, I was like, that is just like so powerful. And no matter what genre or age group I write for, you'll know if you read a Kosoko Jackson story, the Black main character is not going to die.
Mm-hmm. I like that. So let's jump into Survive the Dome. Before we get into the plot, what really inspired this book? When did you think I need to write this story talking about the Black Lives Matter protests and ongoing police brutality in our country?
It was actually about 3 to 5 days after the George Floyd shooting. I lived in New York City. There was a lot of protests going on. Obviously, it was in the height of the pandemic. Like, I couldn't go out. And so I was like, how do I write my resistance? I always consider writing to be like an act of resistance, especially writing positive Black queer characters. It's a very radical thing. And so it's been something that if you follow me on Twitter, I talk about often. So I was like, how do I actually walk the walk and talk the talk? And I feel like Survive the Dome kind of like embodied that. I had a different book from my publisher, and like watching about the protest, I was like, I need to do something. And so I was like, how do I marriage this idea of protest with my like science fiction YA brand? And this book kind of just like burst from my head.
All right. So our point of view character is Jamal Lawson. Can you tell me the plot of the book and where do we find Jamal at the beginning?
Sure. So Jamal Lawson is an aspiring journalist and an aspiring graduate from high school. He really wants to get into a journalism program, specifically a photojournalism program. And just recently, about 3 months earlier, there was a shooting of a Black man in Baltimore and the acquittal of a cop who shot him. So protests are happening in Baltimore. Initially, Jamal thinks that this is a great opportunity to go down, take photos, and for his thesis submission for undergraduate school so he can get scholarships. And so he goes down with the intention of kind of like a self-centered opinion, very kind of honestly, a very teenager mm-hmm. point of view, and then gets roped up into this thriller survival when a dome gets put over Baltimore that prevents all information from leaving and also people from leaving. And it's like half a journey of survival, half a journey of trying to like empower queer Black and brown communities, and also just a journey of self-discovery of kind of what does it mean to be young and Black in America.
Yeah, I watched one of your interviews where you said, I put my foot in this character. What do you mean by that?
Oh, I did say that. Sometimes interviews come back to bite me, and I'm like, did I say that? I feel like Jamal was the most me character that I've ever written. I really don't like to write me characters, and like my mother, who reads all my books, is always like, oh, this has a bit of you in it. And I'm like, Linda, you don't know what you're talking about. but Jamal, I feel like, was like back in the day, and for anyone in the audience who like follows me on Twitter, you know I am a very militant Black person. And like if you knew me in high school, I was like, racism doesn't exist. So like I was a very different person in high school than I am now. And I think that's reflected in like Jamal's arc. Like the protests are very important to him as a Black person with a lowercase b, but not like a capital B, until he really gets involved with them and he sees what the effects of police brutality face to face do and how communities are rallying against it. Like I said earlier, Jamal only went because he thought it would be a great way to do a college application and get to college. Yeah. He still understood what was going on and why it was bad, but he wasn't going to protest. He was going to protest for photography. And I think that arc, it's really, really important. When I was writing this book compared to Yesterday's History, which has Andre, who's a very woke character, I've learned and like grown and figured out that like, I honestly think being woke is privileged. And that a lot of people who grow up in America, in rural America, in all parts of America, you can't be like outward and Black and woke and expect to survive or get where you need to. And so I kind of wanted to write a book that showed an arc of a character who didn't start out perfectly, because I wasn't perfect in high school.
One of the other characters who helps guide Jamal's journey is Marco. You know, how are these characters similar but very different at the same time?
Yeah, so Marco is a hacker, and to not to give up too much information about like his character, he's there for a specific reason, but like he's a hacker. And he's also Jamal's love interest. Marco's kind of like the opposite end of the coin. He's very much more like down for the cause, and that's kind of like his whole identity. It also has an element of retribution in it that is discovered throughout the story. But he's very much like the individual who nudges Jamal along outwardly and very point blankly, but also subtly, to help him see like there is another side to existence. I wanted to create a character, oftentimes when we talk about rebellions, revolutions, rightfully so, we focus on Black characters and Black people because so much in our current society has been done by Black people. But I strongly believe that many revolutions and rebellions are done by POC children and teens in general. And I wanted to show all teens that there's a space for you in here. Even though the police brutality that we come and hear about in the news is targeting Black people, it affects every single one of us. And I wanted to show that in the story and also show how other people fight back.
Mm-hmm. You know, Baltimore is an interesting site, not only because in April 2015, with the killing of Freddie Gray, they had their own uprisings. It's been, you know, talked about in the zeitgeist with shows like The Wire. You know, why was Baltimore the place you wanted to set this story?
Partially because I'm from Maryland and I've never written a Maryland story before. And so I've had a lot of friends and family been like, when are you going to set a story in Maryland? You've done Boston twice and you need to set one in Maryland. But also because I remember like the Freddie Gray violence. I remember being in Maryland. I remember my mom being like, you're not going there. I remember my thoughts about Baltimore. Maryland in and of itself is kind of like a microcosm. Like you have Baltimore, but then like also even people outside of Baltimore have thoughts about Baltimore that aren't true. I've done teaching in Baltimore. I have a lot of events and like I've done book events and educational events in Baltimore. And I just thought it was a perfect place to show a growing community of Black people and to also just touch on like income disparity in Baltimore. I think Baltimore is a good example of how there's like a huge homeless population in this working class city. There are more empty homes in Baltimore than there are homeless people. And that's just like something that I find to be completely repulsive. So I was like, where can I set a story that is like Blackety Black, but also is something personal to me, that also the city itself is a character that represents oppression. And I was like, Baltimore seemed perfect.
And I heard somebody giggle when you said Blackety Black, and I felt it too. I tried to restrain it. It's not just set in Baltimore, and it doesn't just cover the Black Lives Matter protests, but you're also jumping, you know, into the science fiction genre. This got shadow organizations, drones, high-tech cops, and of course, like the title suggests, the big-ass dome. You know, why was telling this story through a science fiction lens so important to you? I heard that you were a Doctor Who fan who is going to be played by a Black man next. You know, why was science fiction so important for you to explore?
A three-part. My YA career has been science fiction. Yesterday's History is science fiction. So part of it was like, from a marketing standpoint, I needed to follow that trend. The other part of it is that like, it was a little bit rebellion. YA science fiction is probably one of the smallest genres that exist. There's just not much YA science fiction, partially because publishers don't believe that teens can grapple with like complex scientific thought. And so I was like, there is a way to discuss this and be cool and badass without having to like, make it have 20 pages discussing like how the dome is created. And so I wanted to show that like this is a thing. And also like science and teens and Black teens, there's a through line between how often do we have Black teens, let alone Black men, in these roles of like a badass leadership role that's like equal to like Marvel or other science fiction genres where they can be these types of heroes. And so I wanted to do that. I've always grown up, like you said, I've been a big science fiction fan. I used to devour Doctor Who. Now I have to get back into Doctor Who.
Another character whose perspective we sit with for some time are the mothers of Jamal and Marco, and those, what those relationships are like. How are they similar and how are they different, their relationships with their respective moms in the story?
I think that both of the mothers in the story want honestly what's best for their children, but I wanted to show that through different lens of how what is best manifest. I think Jamal's mother very much has like a more docile, like kind of like a little bit of a backseat role. Like she wants her child to be safe, which I think 99.9% of mothers want them to be, while Marcos is very much like he has learned about rebellions and learned about activism from his mother. And that way of safety is like a safety for all. Like you've been taught skills and learned from me how to not only protect yourself and to help yourself, but also to help others. While Jamal's mother is more focused on like our family unit as a whole, which to me is a representation of like the Black and POC community as a whole.
Mm-hmm. When we meet Catherine, who is another central character, Marco and Jamal, I mean, for all practical purposes, they're beaten down. They've been through some things. You know, I think they're coming out of the police station. Can you tell me about Catherine? I remember watching an interview and you said this is a new character in a way that you're writing, because many of the women you've written have been different. Catherine has like a military background. Can you talk about this character a little bit?
Yeah, sure. So Catherine comes from a military background. She just graduated from basic training. And so she's very much more like the muscle of the group. Kind of two things. We know so many great series, The Hunger Games, Divergent, Percy Jackson, have this triad, usually two boys and a girl. And typically, and even in all of these, the girl is typically the smart one. And so I kind of think that the YA tropes have the smart one, the one who is the most courageous one, and the one with the most heart. But I wanted to kind of flip that on its head. I wanted to make the girl the strong one and the muscle one, and have the main character be the one with the heart, not the super smart one. And I think that's like how I created these characters. But for me, my female characters tend to gravitate into like one archetype, which I consider girls with like severe bob cuts who are like valedictorians in their class. I like to write incredibly smart female characters. And though Catherine is smart, she's smart in a different way. She's smart militarized, she's street smart, she's more physical. If one of these three is gonna kill somebody, it's gonna be Catherine, and she's gonna sleep fine at night. And I've never written that type of character before, let alone that type of female character before. And it was so fun to like write. Like, if these three children had to, and you had to put your bets on who would survive, I would put my money on Catherine. The other two boys are gonna die by themselves.
I mean, just in the way you said that, and sleep good at night, there was sort of a tension that comes with that. What was it like writing this sort of fast-paced story? Because for all practical purposes, it happens in a pretty quick amount of time. What was it like keeping that tension up, keeping, you know, working to keep your reader engaged as you're going through this fast-paced story?
It was hard. My roots are in more literary slow burn stories. So to get to here was like, props to my agent, Jim McCarthy. We've been working on how to write commercial stories for like 2+ years. And I kind of figured like, this is the version of that. To me, and probably a sad thing, is that this story came very easy to me. I wrote Survive the Dome in 3 months. The first draft was about 96,000 words. And I just burn through it because I put so much of being a Black boy in America into the story that nothing in here was hard to write. Hard to write emotionally, yes, but nothing felt far-fetched. Nothing felt like something that I was going too far out of. Every single scene felt like it could happen in a world that was hyper-militarized or in just the normal.
Mm-hmm. I mean, we're going to keep experiencing, unfortunately, police brutality, police shootings, protests. Do you think we're moving closer to a world in which something like the Dome is realistic? Because, I mean, let's be real, with the cell phone technology we have, with the surveillance we have now, at times it feels like we're living in one where we're in a city in which they can just raise the bridges and say, you can't go there. You can get cut off very quickly. Does it feel like we're moving very rapidly towards like a literal dome in a sense?
I don't know if I feel like we're moving like directly there, but I mean, who knows what technology has? Like Fort Meade is a big place in the story, like tangentially, partially because it has a lot of militarized and scientific discoveries happen at Fort Meade. But also like, I kind of inspired the dome, not only by Stephen King's dome, but the idea of like tractor beams and domes from like Star Trek Discovery. But also Russians have used technology back in the day that was like sound-based technology to cause headaches, nausea, and just complete disruption of people without ever penetrating walls. And that was like such a unique thing that they would blast sound waves for like 2 hours a day, turn it off, you could never track it. And people were getting sick, vomiting, bloody. That seems like a scientific thing to me 5 or 10 years ago, but we have that technology now. So do I think that a impenetrable dome where humans can't exit is something that we're close to? Probably not, but I could definitely see the idea of information being unable to leave a designated area is not an unfathomable concept. We just need to take it a couple steps further.
Yeah. Can we talk a little bit about the antagonists in this story? You even start your prologue with one of them. Why was it so important with you to start with that perspective?
When I wrote Survive the Dome, I knew, and my agent and I had a strong talk about this, that like there's kind of two things. There's no positive white people in the story and there's no positive cops, which is a very strong stance to take in this day and age.
But is it?
I think it is. I think it is in literature. You don't know how many emails I've gotten that have been like, Survive the Dome would be a better book if you showed the nuanced take that there are some good cops out here. And I was like, well, you obviously didn't read the book because it's clearly clear where the stance of this book is from. And so when I wrote Governor Ambrose, who is the villain of the story, I wanted to show that like corruption infiltrates everything, but I also wanted to show some nuance of that character. I don't think that Governor Ambrose is at all a redeemable character or a good character in any stretch of the imagination, but there is a specific part in the prologue that talks about her saying that like, as a woman making these grand and over the top attempts to make something good or to make myself known is the only way that I can get by. And if she was a man, she wouldn't have to do this. So I wanted to touch on at least briefly how corruption affects every single group that can be marginalized, maybe not in direct ways. But if Governor Ambrose was a man, we wouldn't probably have the story.
What about the police chief, you know, who really serves as a muscle, as a voice throughout this? Between that and the even more militarized, technologically advanced police, you got a lot of standoffs between your characters and these figures. What was it like to write those scenes?
I think to me, they felt like manifestations of things that I could never do in real life. Jamal is far braver than I would ever be, because there's probably a scene in, there's a scene in there where the police chief offers him a way out. And there might have been a time in my life where I have taken that. Like, I am not against saying that, because it takes a lot to be brave, to put yourself on the line, to put your friends on the line. And I wanted to put this boy in situations where he had to make hard choices, where there might not be any good outcome. Like, I think a lot of adult choices, which I tried to mirror by having this coming of age story, oftentimes are no win situations. You just have to figure out which is the least bad. And I wanted to kind of like make him navigate those standoffs. Chief Coles is honestly the most horrible character. He has no redeeming qualities. There's nothing great about him. He is just a manifestation of everything wrong with the police system.
You sold him up the river too. I ain't gonna give too much away, but you, I just had a question related to Jamal. You know, you give Marco this ability as a hacker, and you give Catherine this background. It's not to say that Jamal comes in empty-handed, but he's not necessarily prepared for this situation in any way. Why was it important for the prime character to be somewhat naive, somewhat selfish, somewhat a little bit ignorant about what they were getting themselves into?
I think the biggest flaw that I see, and which is going to be like a thing to say, like, Suzanne Collins is going to come into my house and beat me up. The biggest problem that I see with some YA stories that are popular is that we always have this special main character. And I understand like why we have that from a storytelling point of view. But for this story, which I was as close to reality as possible, plus some science fiction elements, I wanted teens who read this to be able to see and say that, like, I could be Jamal and I could do this. I didn't want it to be like, I could be Jamal if I was 10 times smarter or if I knew military technology. I could be thrown into a situation like this and be able to navigate it and survive. And I think that's really important, because most rebellions and leadership doesn't come from kids who have millions of dollars. They don't come from kids who have the richest of training. They come from children who care and who are passionate and have something to tell. The Parkland students is a great example. These were just normal public school kids who have changed the way we talk about gun violence. And I kind of wanted to mirror that in the story, so that any teen who saw this maybe 5 years or now, 5 years from now, could be in a protest and remember that, like, they can be empowered to make a change.
Mm-hmm. When you're reader is going through this book, how do you want them to feel as they're traveling this arc with Jamal? Not just the tension, but are they to leave this story inspired that they can make a difference, or that, you know, despite all your best hopes and attempts, you're still facing an extremely uphill battle?
I think if I had to like summarize like what I wanted a reader to take away as simply as possible, is that Martin Luther King's quote, the moral arc always bends towards justice, which is very paraphrased. Change takes time. And I think that sometimes of our attention span in the world that we live in, we expect it to be very binary. Things will either happen or they won't. But oftentimes it takes building blocks upon building blocks for years for positive change can happen. And it takes small increments. And I would like for individuals to take away that, like, your actions might seem like they don't matter, but they absolutely do. The smallest choice of going to a protest with somebody matters. Walking your female identifying friend home from the bus station late at night matters. Like, these choices that you make, small inconsequential choices, actually have major effects. And so I don't like to write stories where, like, there's a moral to it, because I think morals are very, we could have a whole conversation about morals, but I do think that it's important for individuals to understand that, like, you have a voice and you have a space, and to just think about, like, the choices that you make.
Mm-hmm. I know you said you see yourself in Jamal a lot. Are there other people in your life or the figures you look up to who you've written into this book in some ways?
I would say that my mentor, Jasmine, who is dedicated in I'm So Not Over You, is very much a representation of the movements that come from Marco's mother. I would say that my mother herself, she was tangential to the Black Panther movement. My grandmother has relationships to SNCC. Back in the civil rights era, my whole family comes from an activist family. And so I kind of put a lot of that into the heart of the story, not specific characters, but in the heart and the vibe of the story comes from that background.
Mm. Can you talk about, I think you spoke to it earlier about the writing being your sometimes refuge during the pandemic, but how is it also your activism is alongside that lineage of your family?
Yeah, I would say that, and it took me a while to like get used to this because my first couple stories never had Black main characters in them, always queer main characters, but not Black main characters. Even I'm So Not Over You, Hudson, the love interest, was a white guy. And I think that it has helped me understand a lot of self-love about being Black and the value of being Black. I've grown up for so many times like spouting that like diversity matters in our story, but I really didn't walk the walk of writing that diversity in the very beginning because I was always afraid that there was no place for me on the bookshelf. We see so often that like we want these type of queer stories, but we still see and hear from authors that like publishing will say we only want one Black story. And so if I had to choose back in the day between writing a Black story that might get published or writing a queer story that I know publishing would gobble down, I always chose the queer story over the Black story. And I think that was a small part of that was some self-hate that came from the idea that my stories weren't good enough or that I wasn't good enough. And so I write these stories with these positive Black influences that might not be perfect, that might have bad pacing, that might not have the perfect arcs, because we don't have that many Black stories out there. Like, we still are growing. We are still building. There are so many Black authors who are increasing the numbers. And I just think writing these stories in and of itself is changing the way that diversity is viewed in literature.
As you're deciding what stories to tell, what characters to write as you move forward, do you feel an obligation at this point in your career as you're gaining notoriety to represent those stories in a more intersectional, in a more full, and even in a more joyous way?
That's a good and a hard question, but also I love that I'm getting notoriety. That's great.
Hey, we at the American Writers Museum, we chilling.
No, I actually think it's the opposite. Like, when I first started and I started writing Black characters, I was like, every character that I will write from now on is going to be a Black queer man. And there's power in that. And I do love that. But I also sometimes think it's a little bit limiting. I think that we sometimes, as diverse authors, think and are told that our only lane is this one lane. But how many white male authors do we know who write white male stories, but also white female stories, and just write so many different things? And so as I've actually pushed my writing and grown, look, the sad thing is that not every story works for a Black man. Like, that's just how it has to be. Like, if I'm writing a story about some historical time period, there's no good Black time to be a Black man in like England or the United States. So we got to mix it up somehow. But I do think what's important is that peppering stories with diversity and not creating worlds that are homogenous and only white or don't talk about the atrocities or the horrible things that do happen is a very important thing. I think that creating that realistic tapestry, even if the main character isn't Black, is an important thing to do. We deal with this a lot in queer stories. I think kind of an expression is the cinnamon rollification of queer men, that we can only have positive, happy queer stories is not a good thing. Just like having only stories about Black drug dealers or welfare queens is a bad thing. We can have diversity in our stories. Not every Black character, not every queer character has to be a beacon of hope and justice. We can have Black queer villains who are horrible. We can have Black queer Wanda Maximoffs. We can just, diversity is important.
I was watching one of your articles and you said that YA authors feel a responsibility because they know that for some of their readership, I mean, a large portion is still adults, but they feel like they're introducing topics or navigating topics with young people, you know, with something like police brutality, police violence and murder, you know. How do you feel about helping young people navigate that genre, especially as somebody who comes from, you know, I think working in like sensitivity work and making sure that things are not problematic and that they teach versus, you know, traumatize?
Yeah, I think that's really important. So like from my point of view, and to reiterate for someone who might not have read that interview, is that I strongly believe that YA readers have the responsibility because our work is sometimes the first time that readers may see diverse work. It may be the first time that a white person is reading a Black main character. It may be the first time that someone's reading a trans main character. And so there's a different level of responsibility versus adults because teens are not stupid by far, but they are impressionable. And so adults can oftentimes dissect what is fantasy and what is an exaggeration for literature in a different way that a teen can, because that influences them. And so I think there's a really important responsibility that comes from an author in that space, especially for a diverse author who's writing about these things. All of diverse authors who take this time to write these, what I call like social justice subgenre books, it's really important because there's a ripple effect of how teens are going to lead and look into the world based on what we write. If we write a story that shows an incredibly negative representation of a marginalized group, that's going to stick. If we write a story that's nuanced and powerful and shows the nuanced dynamics, that's what people are going to take away from. And so when I wrote Survive the Dome, I made a conscious choice, even though we could argue it is not the most accurate choice, of creating this big, bad, homogeneous idea of the police force. I strongly believe that there is no such thing as a good cop. And I put that inside my book, and it is woven into these pages. And if you disagree with it, that is great, because it made you think and it made you understand and it made you combat a point of view and maybe think in a way in a different, think about something in a different way than you did before. That was my mission. But at the same time, I wanted to write a story where the Black and the POC characters win instead of lose.
Mm-hmm. Something you've seen from protest movements is after the cameras leave, the people who are doing the work on the ground, one, the work doesn't stop, but two, they're often left with this paranoia. They're looking over their shoulders, wondering what's next. Are we safe? Our characters at the end of Survive the Dome, you know, the ones who remain, they're, you know, in a place where they're wondering. And so my question is, you mentioned Divergent, you mentioned Hunger Games. It feels like it leaves us with wanting more, that there's a sequel, that there's a future for these characters that is not just assumed, but you will tap into and we might see. Is that your plans when you were coming up with the end of the book, or did you just want us, you know, hoping for more?
I was hoping for more. There's no plans for a sequel as of now, but like, who knows with sales? Like, there's definitely ideas for sequels. There was originally a epilogue that led too much into a sequel idea since it wasn't a two book deal. So we cut it. My editor was like, readers are going to expect a sequel if you write this. But I guess we didn't end it well enough anyway, because you were like the 20th person to tell me that. So yeah, if someone wants to pay me for a sequel, I am more than happy to write one.
Hey, there was so much that was pointing forward. The journey, the look, the door. I was there with you. I was like, come on, you gotta go talk to mom. You gotta get out there. All right, I'm gonna stop. You know, what do you want people, again, I've asked in some ways, but what do you want people to take away when they close this book and not just, you know, where's the next one coming from?
I think to reiterate something I said earlier, I think I want to take away that like, it doesn't matter who you are or where you are in social status or anything. There's a space for you if you want to change the world, be it through activism, be it through a book writing, be it through just sharing and uplifting voices. We all have our power to like change the world, especially with a midterm coming up. I understand that we are tired about voting and things not turning out the way that they should be. Trust me, as a liberal, I am very tired of having these promises that aren't met. And I will always tell people that we need to still vote, but even if you don't vote, please don't not vote. But even if you don't not vote, there are other things you can do. Even the smallest actions of adopting a Senate race, donating $5, volunteering an hour of your time, all of these things matter, and there are ways to make differences. You just have to find the way that's comfortable with you.
Mm-hmm. Maybe it's a heavy question to end on, but especially when you're talking about hope, how do you inspire hope when, even as you say, we look up and just in the last couple of weeks, right, the Supreme Court has affirmed that about half our population doesn't have access to certain rights, to their own health care. We've had mass shootings over the weekend. We've continued to see violence from law enforcement take our streets. How do you continue to aspire your readers towards hope, towards positivity, when there's so much shouting at them, you know, from a negative place?
Whew, that's a hard one. Like, it's been a hard couple weeks, the past through few weeks. My biggest way to still inspire hope as best I can is remember that like, things ebb and flow, and that there will be a change in the future. The quote is a little bit like corny, but like, even the darkest night will end and the sun will rise. It's something that I kind of do think about sometimes. I think the biggest thing that I try to stay away from is apathy. And I try to not become just like apathetic or not caring. As a Black queer man, of course, I have many marginalizations, and many of us do, but I am also a liberal who lives in New York City area, who is very privileged with his income, and I am kind of in a liberal bubble. So it's easy to become apathetic to the plight that doesn't affect me personally. But I also remember that it doesn't have to affect me personally to affect me, because what affects somebody else affects all of us in the end. And so I try to remind people, at least myself, to stay hopeful by finding those individuals who are acting and doing the things that you want to support and working hard to create the world that you want to create, and kind of just siphon off of their hope and work with them together. I've gotten my most inspiration just from as an activism standpoint, just by talking with those who believe in things and haven't had their faith faltered. That to me is some of the strongest stuff.
I feel you. Even in the darkest nights, the sun will rise, but my heart is with those who perished in the moonlight. Kosiko Jackson, the author of Survive the Dome, I'm so grateful that you took time, even with how you're feeling, to join us today and to talk about this great book.
Thank you to our program participants for being here today, and for all of you for allowing us to celebrate American writing. Again, please join me in thanking Kosoko and Jacoby.
Thank you so much. Very well done, Kosoko.
Have a great day.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the AWM Author Talks podcast. Next week, Kim Michelle Richardson chats about her new novel, The Bookwoman's Daughter. Now go. Be inspired and find the mind of a writer in yourself.